Good evening, and welcome everyone to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Amy, and I am an alcoholic.
Amy.
For those of you who care to join us, let's open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. They are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA simple actions. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open, big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing step one. Please welcome our panel this evening. We have Mike from Pocosin and Ryan from Simple Actions. Okay, step one. We had admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. The first reading of this second part is page 5. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business. And so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day, I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did. Mike, you want to start?
Hello, everyone. My name is Mike, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Mike.
Excuse me. Well, first, I guess I should tell you a little bit about myself. I am a member of the Big Book Topic Group in Hampton. We meet on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. at the Wesley United Methodist Church in Armistead Avenue, North Armistead. Those of you who have come to our group before, you may remember that we were in downtown Hampton, but we recently moved and our facilities are wonderful. And we had a great Halloween party a couple nights ago. Over 100 people there, so next time I hope that everyone here can make it. We have it every year. So this reading that we're starting off with, I was looking at it in the respect that Bill is talking about the many times that he kept trying to stop drinking. And I can tell you that I don't think there were many times that I tried to stop drinking. I started drinking when I was a very young child. I started when I was 8 years old. That's when I first discovered alcohol. And from the very first drink that I took, I was instantly hooked. Something within me triggered, and I knew from that moment on that I wanted this substance all the time. At that time, I lived with my father, and he had booze all over the house, in the refrigerator, and everywhere else. And it wasn't difficult for me to find it or steal some of it. He would never know. So from the very beginning, alcohol was just part of my makeup. And that's what I did. I would drink. I'd come home from school. I'd go find a beer in the refrigerator, and I would have it immediately. And that's what I looked forward to the entire day. And all of this continued on through the years until by the time I was 14 years old, I was a regular drinking buddy of my dad's. And you know, I always looked older than my age, so he would take me with him to the nightclubs and the bars and buy drinks for me. And this is what I grew up, I'm not blaming my father or anything, I'm just telling you that from the very beginning, this was what life was like to me. I didn't know that it wasn't normal. So as years would go on, I would get in trouble with drinking, but it never occurred to me that this was I was getting in trouble because I was drinking. I was getting in trouble because everybody else was on my back. I was blaming all my problems on everybody else or bad luck. And drinking was not something that I could equate to the problems that I was having. In fact, I had to drink just to feel normal. That was the only way that I could associate with people was by drinking. And that's what made me feel right. So when the time came that I finally realized after several treatment centers that maybe there was something wrong with me physically, I eventually came to that realization and tried to stop drinking a few times, maybe, I don't know, 3-4 times, but I couldn't tolerate it. I couldn't stand not drinking. And by that time, I had resigned myself to the fact that this is the price that I was going to have to pay. I have to drink, and I don't care what's going to happen, and I will pay whatever the price might be. And I'll get into that a little bit more as we get along.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. I'm Ryan. My name is Ryan, and I'm an alcoholic. I like Bill's story. It took me a while to appreciate it. One of the things that struck me over the years is he is a great example of what it means to be powerless over alcohol. Because he shows us all the ways that don't work for an alcoholic to get sober. And this is a kind of a classic one. I woke up, this had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. So here we have a guy with a desire to stop drinking, who intends to stop drinking, and yet he finds himself drunk again. And I actually did spend quite a bit of my time attempting to stop drinking. It took a while before I got to that point because I really, really loved to drink. There was just something kind of magical and wonderful about it. I used to call it liquid freedom. because I would walk around all the time just feeling like uptight and kind of just not quite right. My mind would frequently be racing. I was just kind of like on edge constantly. And when I would drink, all of that stuff would disappear, and it was great. So when I started to notice that perhaps my drinking wasn't quite right, my first thought was not, wow, I need to quit drinking. My first thought was, I need to quit drinking so much. And I had made a lot of futile attempts to do that. I remember one time my boss brought me into his office because I was having trouble showing up at work on time and put together and smelling good. That was a great conversation. And he told me, Ryan, you really need to lay off the booze. And I was like, you are absolutely right. I definitely need to lay off the booze. And I remember getting off work that day and going home and stopping by the store and purchasing a couple of bottles of wine. And I know what you're thinking. Look at you getting drunk again. But my intention was to buy a couple of bottles of wine so that it would like last me like a week or so and I wouldn't have to go to the store all the time. That was my great intention. And so I got home, put the wine up, and with the intention of drinking one or two. And of course, that did not happen, you know. I did a lot of things like that. I thought for a while that perhaps the problem was that I was getting dehydrated because I would wake up with hangovers a lot of the time. And so I was like, water, I just need to cut my vodka with water. Apparently, when you are drinking in the quantities that I was, you can drink all the water you want. It is not doing you any good. So I did a lot of things like that. And I kind of remember one of those wake-up moments. I was the closet drinker. I was the girl with booze hidden in her glove box and in her closet and under the bed and anywhere else I thought that you wouldn't find it, but I could easily access it if I needed a couple of drinks. I remember one day I had, there was this water closet, I don't even know what to call it. There was a water heater in there and it had a door. And that's where I hid my empties until I could like scramble around Thursday morning and get them out of the house. And I remember I was putting one of the empties away and I'm pretty sure my husband heard me close that closet. And he went down the hall and he opened that closet. He got to see the thing that I was trying to hide from everybody. You know, all those empties in there. And there was just this horrible feeling, you know. And that's when I woke up and I knew that it had to stop. And unfortunately for me, that's where things started to get a little bit weird for me. Because no matter how many times I woke up, no matter how many times there were really good reasons for me to quit, no matter how many times I promised that no, I'm not going to do this again, I would find myself doing it again. Just like Bill Wilson, you know, that willpower, that desire to quit, that threat of consequences, dear God, it just didn't touch me. Thank you.
We're continuing on page 7. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely, this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum.
I was in the U.S. Air Force, and I had joined the Air Force so I could get away from home and be able to drink like I wanted to. and do what I wanted to. And I thought I would have all the freedom in the world now that I was away from home. Well, anybody who's ever been in the military knows you don't get much freedom and you do what they tell you to do. So it wasn't long before I got my first DWI. I had just moved to Guam that was my first duty station. And anybody who's ever been there will probably know that it's a single man's paradise. Very beautiful place. Beautiful in all aspects. So sometime, I think, after my first DWI, by now I was 19, I started to, they put me in a, they didn't put me in a hospital or anything, but they made me go to an outpatient treatment. And when I was in this outpatient treatment thing, I was not supposed to be drinking. And I think it was supposed to go on for like 4 weeks or something like that. And during those first 2 weeks, I started to really feel the effects, the physical effects of what it was like to not drink, because I was a daily drinker. And I had been such since I was a young kid. And I was, you know, everybody knows how you feel when you can't have a drink. I was irritable and I was shaky and I was always having hangovers or some sort of, you know, my head was hurting constantly and I was just in a bad mood. And this was unusual for me to be in this kind of a mood because I always, always was able to get what I needed to calm myself physically and I just couldn't take this feeling. I think it was the third week of this outpatient treatment. I walked up to my supervisor and I told him that there's a party at somebody's house tonight and I'm going there and I'm going to get drunk. If you need to report me, go ahead. I don't care. So unfortunately, for my supervisor, he also happened to be my best friend and he was going to be at the party too. So he was caught between a rock and a hard place. And you know, he was my friend and he was also my supervisor. So I had kind of put him in a bad situation by telling him what I was going to be doing and leaving it up to him whether he was going to turn me in. But that's where I was heading. I was heading to a point where physically I needed the drink so bad that I didn't care how that would affect my future. Because I had been already told that if I continued to drink and if I drank while I was in this treatment, I was going to be discharged with a bad discharge from the military. And, you know, that stuff affects you for the rest of your life. So, you know, I don't know why people like us just can't, well, I know why, but we can't seem to look beyond that insatiable desire that we need that drink at that moment. We can't look into the future and say, this is going to affect me in a negative way. And in many cases, like for me, I just didn't even care anymore. I had to have my fix. And this paragraph that we're talking about reminds me of how desperate I had become for that drink, willing to give up my future for it. Thanks.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you. All right. So here's where Bill Wilson kind of shows us the other thing that doesn't work to combat alcoholism, and that is self-knowledge. And that was my first go-to. I kind of figured that I was a pretty smart girl. I should be able to figure this stuff out and quit. And that did not go so well. So I found myself sitting in a rehab facility. I had had a therapist that had mentioned AA, but I like looked up the meetings and it was a bad part of town and I wasn't going to go there. And I used to like TiVo that, what was that one show? Intervention, yes. I loved to TiVo Intervention. And I would sit at home on Friday nights and get drunk and watch Intervention. And I just had this idea in my head that if I went to, you go to rehab and it magically fixes it and then everybody turns out happily ever after. Now, I don't know how I got that idea from Intervention because I've watched it since sober and it's just completely tragic, but that's what I really thought that I needed to do. So I did. I hunted around and I found this rehab facility. I spent 21 days in that one. I'm a rehab retread. And that's what they gave me. They gave me a lot of self-knowledge. They gave me the disease model of alcoholism. We had like a little workbook that we had to do. They taught us about triggers. I always kind of laugh at triggers because what do you do when your trigger is being conscious? You know, we're just going to sleep all the time. You know, all of those things. And so I stayed in that facility for 21 days. And I got lots and lots and lots of self-knowledge. And what I can tell you is that the day came when all that stuff went out the window and I found myself with a drink in my hand again. It was not sufficient to prevent me from drinking. I love what it says in the doctor's opinion. He talks about a type of drinker who does not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. And when I look back at all the things that I did, I feel like I did all the things that any normal human being would do if they had a drinking problem and they wanted to get over it. You know, I saw the therapist. You know, I had like this really nice lady. We even did like a meditation together, like this, and I saw a manatee. You know, that didn't stop me from drinking. You know, get healthier, right? Get your endorphins going. If you just feel good, you won't drink so much. That was one of my thoughts. And what that would look like is I would get home and I would walk around the block once and I would walk around the block twice and the crap in my head went from a 10 to an 8 and I had to have a drink. You know, all the things that I think that I should do and they just didn't seem to work. You know, and that's where I start to get to understand what it means to be powerless over alcohol, to be beyond human aid. Thank you.
Can I add something?
Please.
Thank you, Ryan, for your description of the treatment center. And yes, they did try to teach us what alcoholism does to you and how it affects you and the way that you think and all that kind of stuff. And I heard all that. I listened to them tell me about it, but I knew that they were talking about the other people in my group. They weren't really talking about me. And that's probably the strongest indication of how delusional I was with my alcoholic thinking. Despite all the evidence and all the people that were around me trying to help me understand that there was something wrong with me, I could never absorb any of that information because I had built the walls up so high and so thick. And I could never hear the counselors or the psychiatrists or the people that kept trying to help me and telling me, showing me where I was my life was leading me and how this alcohol, how much I drank and how it was affecting me and how it was affecting people around me. I couldn't see any of that stuff and I didn't want to because that meant that I would have to stop drinking. And the thought of having to give up alcohol was unbearable to me. And therefore I protected myself by denying everything that they kept showing me and I just didn't want any part of that.
We're going to continue reading about the mind of the alcoholic on page 24. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove.
Well, we've lost the power of choice in drink. I don't think I ever had the power of choice. It was just a necessity. It had to be that way. I drank, that was just part of my life. Why would I want to stop? My problems weren't caused by alcohol, it was caused by everybody else wanting me to be a certain way. Why can't you just let me be the way that I am? I'm not hurting anybody. If anything, I might just be hurting myself. You know, this trying to tell me that I should choose to stop drinking is just ludicrous, because that was just part of my life. I mean, I don't know how else to say that. Now, it talks about using willpower. Of course, just like anybody else, I had my incidents, I had my problems, I had things that happened, fights, getting in trouble, spending time in jail, and all that kind of stuff that goes along with this. But, you know, those were certainly not enough to help me to not drink that night. Those were just the price that you pay to be able to drink the way that I wanted to. And the idea that I will be able to remind myself that these consequences are going to occur if I continue to drink or pick up that next drink is just, it wasn't strong enough. It wasn't, I wasn't able to conjure those up in a way that would scare me. Maybe in the beginning it did a little bit, but after that, you know, you just get used to everything that happens and you go along with it. And, you know, as time goes on, my moral compass gets lower and my ability to accept more and more problems gets higher. And, you know, you just become, it's difficult for me to just tell myself, don't drink, when I really must have it physically and emotionally. It's a necessity. So I was never able to force myself to not drink. You know, maybe occasionally, I better not take a drink tonight because I have to go to this place. But once I took that first drink, all bets were off and I had to have more after that. Thanks.
Thank you. So I really, really love this little section here. It kind of reminds me every time I hear somebody say in a meeting, you have to remember your last drunk, I get a little bit irritated. And then what I can tell you is that this paragraph absolutely blows that idea out of the water. Because what it tells me right here is the suffering and the pain from my last drunk will not be sufficient to stop me from picking up the next drink. And oddly enough, it talks about being powerless against the first drink. I didn't learn that until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. For quite some time, I was aware that I was an alcoholic. I was aware that I needed to quit drinking. I spent a lot of time and effort trying not to drink unsuccessfully. And I remember getting out of that first rehab, they had brought meetings into that facility every single day. And so we were going to meetings right away. And then they gave us a big book. And oddly enough, I read that entire big book while I was in rehab. But I was hooked right away. And I just, somewhere along the line, I got this idea that if you're an alcoholic and you want to get sober, you go to AA. And I heard the things that they normally tell us, which is things like 90 and 90, get phone numbers. And so I was in Texas at the time, and I moved back to Virginia because the husband didn't want much to do with me, and the mom would take me in. And so I did. I started to go into Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to admit, I've never once achieved 90 and 90. But I did go to 6 meetings a week. I took the Sundays off to spend with the family. And I got the phone numbers, and I put them in my phone. And there was this lady, I asked her to be my sponsor. She always wanted to meet with me. And I heard them talking about spiritual stuff and the steps. And I just kind of figured that somebody would tell me when it was time to do it. And things went well. I kind of got my life back together. I got a job. I got enrolled in school. The husband and I had reconciled. I stayed here because he was about to go on a deployment. And I remember it was 4 months to the day. My cousin was getting married, and we go to the wedding. They have the little wedding, and we're walking back to the reception. And I remember about halfway back to it, I just had this idea in my head out of the blue. You know what? I just want to have one drink so that I can relax and have fun with my family. And I'm going to drink tonight, and I'm going to quit tomorrow. And I remember walking into that reception, and I go up to the bartender, and I ordered a vodka straight, and he looked at me a little weird. I guess people don't order that a lot, but he was very nice to me. He poured me a nice little glass of vodka, and I drank that glass of vodka with the intention of it being the only one. And what I can tell you is it wasn't the only one. I spent the rest of the night out on the back bar drinking because everybody knew I was supposed to be sober now. Pretty much missed it. And what I can also tell you is that I didn't drink that night and quit the tomorrow. I was probably a bit of a binge drinker back in my younger days. But at that point, I was an all day, every day, as much as I can get my hands on kind of drinker. And even to this day, I cannot fully explain to you what happened to me in that moment. It's like I just forgot it was a bad idea to drink. I'm not quite sure how you forget something that important. 4 months ago, I was sitting in a rehab facility and my husband had left. You know, I have forgotten about all the lies that I was going to tell, the people that I was going to hurt, the things that I would do when I would drink. You know, all those phone numbers and stuff didn't even cross my mind. You know, when I was a kid, I remember, I was probably in second or third grade, and I have no idea why I did this, but the teacher, she had a stapler on her desk. And for some reason, I decided to go up to that stapler, stick my finger under the stapler, and slam the stapler down. And what I can tell you is it hurt really, really bad. And what I have never done since that day is gone up to somebody's desk, stick my hand under the stapler, and slam it down. I learned my lesson. But with alcohol, I could never learn my lesson. You know, I always went back to it. You know, when it starts to talk about being powerless over the first drink, I get that. At some point in time, it's going to be a good idea, and ain't nothing going to stop me. It's going to happen. And I only have to forget long enough to get that drink up to my lips and take the first swallow. Because after that, all bets are off. You know, I got that physical allergy where I'm just going to crave more, and we ain't stopping. You know, that's what it means to be powerless. Thank you.
The next reading is from page 34. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. How then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking?
I can tell you what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about how good I'm going to feel after I have a drink. I'm thinking about all the wonderful things that are going to happen. I'm thinking of all the girls I'm going to pick up. I'm thinking of how I'm going to be like Superman. You know, these are the kind of thoughts that go through my mind when I say that I want to have the next drink. I need it just to feel normal, but I want it because I want all of these wonderful things that I think I'm supposed to have. And alcohol is what gave me that power, at least in my mind it did. In reality, it was nothing like that. But what comes to my mind is the last attempt at stopping drinking. I had just come out of my second treatment center, and I had gone back to my Air Force base where I was stationed, this time in Loring Air Force Base, Northern Maine, in a small town called Caribou, Maine, if anybody has ever heard of that place. And this was in the dead of winter. In those days, I don't know if they still do this or not, but in those days, the first thing they did when you came out of treatment was they put you on Anabuse. And that was their way of making sure that you wouldn't drink. So every day I would have to go stand in front of the counselor and take this pill in front of her. And I was just utterly humiliated every time I had to do this. Because deep down inside, I really wanted to drink. But they had shown us videos of what happens to you if you drink on Anabuse and all this kind of stuff. And whether it was true or not, I don't know, but I fell for it. So fast forward maybe 2 or 3 weeks, something like this, and I am just, I'm desperate. I really must have a drink. It's been, what, like almost 2 months now. A month in treatment and a month out of it, taking Anabuse. And I really had to have it. And I started walking around the dorms. I lived in the dorms then, and I'm banging on people's doors trying to get something to drink from them. And nobody's answering the door. I mean, this is just ridiculous. This is the party dorm, and there's nobody there to answer the doors and give me something to drink. So I really had nowhere else to go. I'm walking down the road, and this is like, I don't know, December, January, something like that. And there had been a blizzard the day before. The snow is up to your knees. I'm wading through the snow, and I'm really pissed. I'm just really looking for a place to go die now, because I cannot have a drink. And I walked probably a couple of miles, and I happened to reach this community center. And I saw some lights on in there. By now I'm freezing. So I end up walking into this community center just to warm up a little bit. And there's a guy down at the end of the hall fumbling with a key in a lock. And I found out that this was the guy setting up an AA meeting. So somehow I stumbled into a community center where they were setting up an AA meeting, and the guy ends up breaking the key in the lock. And I'm just like, now I'm really devastated. I needed a drink. Somehow I end up at an AA meeting, and now there's not going to be an AA meeting. I'm really confused. I mean, I have no idea what the hell is going to happen next. And that was the beginning of my change of heart, of what my life was going to be like. I had a moment of clearness in my mind where I was ready to go walk out into the deep, deep snow and never be seen again, and somehow end up here with this guy from AA. And I'm sitting there looking at these two options, and really there was, I guess this must have been the first time I made a choice about my drinking, and I choose to hang out with this guy. And then eventually I went to my first AA meeting. So that was my, that was probably one of the most important nights of my life. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, for those who are unable to drink moderately, am I the person who can drink and keep it under control? Am I the person who can have like those two or three social drinks and then stop? No. Been there, done that, got the t-shirt, doesn't work, tried really hard. So the question becomes how to stop altogether. I like what it talks about over here. What sort of thinking dominates the alcoholic who repeats time after time? I wish I knew what all the paragraphs we were going to read were. The experiment of the first drink. My first sponsor, she told me, she said, the insanity of alcoholism isn't that when I drink too much. The insanity of alcoholism is that stone cold sober, I will pick up a drink and do it again. You know, and ain't that the truth? And I kind of laugh here when they're starting to talk about like figure out insanity. Like, you know, like if I could just pinpoint which thoughts are causing this problem, you know, then I could fix it. You know, and for me, the wide variety of thoughts I get, I mean, who can plan for all those contingencies? You know, because my mind's telling me like, hey, it's been a bad day at work. You should have a drink. Hey, it's a Friday night. You should have a drink. Hey, it's a hurricane. 10 a.m. is a perfect time to start, you know? There's like thousands and thousands and thousands upon thousands of permutations of that. You know, that's what I'm thinking. Anything and everything. It doesn't matter. Something's going to pop in my head, you know? And that's where this inability to, quit on a non-spiritual basis starts to come into play. And I remember that. You know, all these things, we had plenty of character. You know, I certainly thought that I had plenty of character. I was one of those people, I thought that like if you just lived right, then everything would turn out okay. And I tried really hard to live right. You know, that self-knowledge stuff. Once again, I'm a smart girl, I should be able to figure it out. And yet all my figuring it out, all that character that I had, I mean, it just didn't touch it. I remember standing in a bathroom one day looking in the mirror going like, this cannot be my life. You know, this cannot be happening to me. You know, I remember the first time I read this book in that first treatment center where it talked about this is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. This utter inability to leave it alone no matter how great the necessity or the wish. You know, and I just kind of understood that at a gut level when I read that, you know, because I certainly needed to quit drinking and I certainly wanted to quit drinking. I just couldn't figure out how, you know, it was the great mystery. So thank you.
Thank you.
Continuing on page 37. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion, of the ability to think straight, be called anything else? You may think this an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that, parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day, we would ask ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity how it could have happened.
I used to have this four-wheel drive pickup truck, and I had fixed it all up, and I would go out into the woods in the mountains of Guam and just fly all over the place with this thing. I loved it. And sometimes I would take some friends and throw them in the back of the truck, and we'd go running through the creeks and up and down the hills and jumping over dunes and stuff like that. So inevitably, we were always drunk. Now, why would I do this? Why would I throw a bunch of people? Why, of course, doing it myself is one thing, but why would I risk the lives of so many other people by doing this? I mean, I never ever remembered what would happen afterwards. I was a blackout drinker. It wouldn't take long before I would just completely black out and not know what would happen the rest of the night. I would be told stories about what had happened. I'd be told stories about people flying out of my truck, getting hurt, or, you know, I'd come back to the place and come back home, and the next morning I'd look for blood or dings or whatever it was on the side of my truck. And, you know, I knew that every time I got good and wasted, I would want to get in my truck and go out and have a good time. And I am so lucky that nobody ever got hurt when they were in my, when they were with me. But there was never any thought to what's going to happen when I start drinking again. And I didn't care what would happen to me or to anybody else. All that mattered was I need to have that drink. And, you know, looking back at it today, I don't know how I could be so irresponsible when it comes to, other people especially. Sure, it's one thing to put yourself in jeopardy, but consistently taking other people and making them, exposing them to danger and hurt and all that kind of stuff is just stupid. So in every instance, it's always what I want out of this. What am I going to get out of this? I never really have used to care. And sometimes, I hate to say this, but even today, I struggle with that thought of, am I doing this because I want to be helpful to another person, or am I doing this because I want something out of it? And this is something that I have to, I mean, I've been sober for almost 32 years now, and I still think this way. It's a big struggle for me to think of myself less and think more of other people. So is that ingrained within me? Am I just naturally self-centered and selfish? The big book tells me so, but it also gives me tools to try to get past that and stop making excuses for my actions and how I affect other people in life. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm not sure how much I have to say about this. I feel like we've been talking about it, but I guess they're really trying to drive home that point. You are powerless over alcohol. Talks about some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink, the sane idea winning out. I mean, the insane idea is that I'm going to drink and it's going to be okay. I like this little bit on next down a little bit, but it says, in some circumstances we have gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. But even in this type of being of beginning, we are obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient in light of what always happened. And I always like to say, there's two reasons why I go out and get drunk. Either I just forget it's a bad idea, or life becomes so intolerable sober that I'm like, screw it, I gotta have a drink. You know, it was really funny because once again, these are lessons that I learned in AA to like get sober and then come back and like read exactly about what I had just experienced. I remember after that first little experiment at the wedding not going so well, finding myself in another detox facility. And at that point, life was really starting to fall apart. The husband had started divorce proceedings and all kinds of crazy stuff. And I got out of that facility, and by golly, I was going to show everybody and stay sober. But all of these things got me, you know, justified by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. And personally, I felt justified. Like anybody going through a divorce, of course, go out, have a drink, blow off some steam, you know. For a non-alcoholic, that's probably a perfectly acceptable way to deal with those things. For somebody who is an alcoholic, who's going through the divorce because of the drinking, to like think that another drink is gonna fix it, hello, something's not quite connecting here. But that's the kind of stuff, you know, even justified in the light of what is going to happen if I take that one drink. It is absolutely insane for me to do it, and yet I will do it again. You know, I remember being like, it took me a while to understand how crazy I was and to get the insanity of alcoholism. But I remember like, oh my God, I really am crazy. You know, what's going on here? Thank you.
Thanks. I am going to read the last two paragraphs. The first is from page 41 and the last is from page 43. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time, I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come. I would drink again. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more, for what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power.
I love that last paragraph. I think I must have been about 2 or 3 months in AA. So I was probably, maybe 4 or 5 months sober at that time. Not sober, without a drink. And I was going to AA quite regularly. Well, that was one of the things they always used to say in the meeting. The day will come when nothing will stand between you and that drink, but a power greater than yourself. And if there was one thing that I ever heard or sunk in, it was that one statement there. And of course, you know, I didn't believe in God in those days, but yet my sponsor kept asking me to at least go through the motions. Act as if there is a God. And he would suggest that I would, pray to some concept that worked for me. And, you know, I would do what he would say, and I would feel really foolish, you know, getting down on my knees and praying in my room with especially with my roommate in there. You know, this is really embarrassing, having to do this in front of other people. And I don't even believe it. But I would still do it, as he had suggested. Well, you know, it was difficult for me to let go of that alcoholic lifestyle. I still wanted to be around my friends. I still wanted to go to the nightclubs with them. I still wanted to, as it says somewhere in our book, live vicariously through them. I couldn't quite let it go. I was going to AA meetings, I wasn't drinking, but I was also going to the bars with my friends. I would justify that by saying that I was going to be the designated driver. I was going to be the designated driver, even though I didn't have a license. But I was going to be the designated driver, and I would bring them all home back safely. After all, I was doing something good for them. So one night, we were headed to a bar, and there was five of us in the car. And a bottle of tequila was being passed around the car. And somebody would take a swig off of it and pass it on to the next guy. And it came by me twice. The first time I was able to pass it on to the next guy and say, no, I'm not drinking. The second time it came by me, I barely handed it on to the next guy. The third time it came by me, I couldn't do it anymore. And this bottle was in my hand, and I was looking at it real close. And it, the powerful attraction was just amazing. And I took that bottle, and I brought it up to my lips. And then this thought came to me that I had heard in the meetings. The day will come when nothing will stand in your way of that drink but a power greater than yourself. And with that bottle in my hand up to my lips, I threw my head back and I prayed to a God I didn't believe in. And I said, God, if you're there, please take this feeling away from me. And I can tell you, I don't know if this is true or not, but I can tell you this amazing feeling came over me, and the compulsion to drink was instantly lifted. And I knew at that moment that there was a God and that I was powerless over this drink. And that moment, everything changed in my life. And I did not want to drink anymore. I did not want to be with these people anymore. I didn't want this lifestyle anymore. Everything that I thought I wanted was immediately cast away. And the desire for a new lifestyle was brought upon me. And that's really where I feel my emotional sobriety began, that I didn't want the old lifestyle and I wanted the new lifestyle. And that's, you know, I'm happy to say I haven't wanted to drink since then. And so, thank you.
Thanks. Keep it quick, but just like he's talking about, his defense must come from a higher power. I love in AA where it starts to talk about this idea of being beyond human aid. Because when I got to AA, I thought the spiritual stuff was really, really weird. I thought that prayer was about as helpful as going to the wall and talking to the wall. And I might have just left. The spiritual approach was not something that I had tried before, so I was at least intrigued, you know. But I learned about what it meant to have no effective mental defense against the first drink, that neither myself nor another human being could provide such a defense. You know, and I tried this higher power stuff simply because I did not know what else to do. You know, because what do you do when you go to the doctors and the doctors can't help you? What do you do when your family isn't able to help you? You know, what do you do when you've been trying as hard as you can and it's still not working? What do you do when you've been going to six AA meetings a week and you're still getting drunk? You know, what do you do when you get the magical sponsor and once again you're still getting drunk? You know, there was nothing left for me but to try the higher power stuff. you know? And I remember coming to that realization, not that so much being afraid of death, but being afraid of being drunk for the rest of my life and having to live in all that chaos and waking up and just seeing the hurt faces and the pain and the messes that were going to come and deciding to give the higher power stuff a try and following through with the 12 steps. And surprisingly enough, it worked. I was quite shocked about that one, but thank you.
Okay. We are going to pass the baskets in accordance with the seventh tradition. The seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it used to. Announcements. Are there any AA-related announcements? Yes, Malcolm. Hey, Malcolm.
Saturday, November 4th, that's this weekend, the Tidewater Intergroup and District 20 here are hosting a gratitude breakfast, fellowship, speakers, food, starting at 9 a.m. Bayside Presbyterian Church, 1400 Yule Road, Virginia Beach, November 4th.
Thanks, Malcolm. Anybody else? Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. Hey, Patrick. Welcome.
Alice.
Hi, Alice. Welcome. All right. Yes. Hi, Brian. Brian, Patrick, and Alice. Welcome. Sponsorship. Oh, literature. Literature is available. It's on the table right there. You can buy books from a home group member. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to come talk to me. Reminders, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside. Stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. Closing, would everyone please join me in thanking Ryan and Mike for their service. Thanks to all who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol. And who will volunteer? Yes. To read the last two paragraphs, BJ.
My
name is
BJ. I'm an alcoholic.
BJ.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
All right, we have a nice way of closing.
Thank you.
David. David. Do you want to,
Our Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Thank you so much for coming.